Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the OMFIF podcast. My name is Lewis McClellan. I'm the editor of the Digital Monetary Institute here at OMFIF, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Andrew Chung, President and CEO of 01 Communique in Canada.
Hi, I'm Andrew Chung, President and CEO of 01 Communique. Nice meeting you here.
Thank you. And William Gee, who's a PwC Hong Kong partner based in China.
Hello, Lewis. Thank you. And nice to meet you all today.
Great. Thank you. So we've got a really fascinating topic to discuss today, post-quantum cryptography. Quantum computing is an extremely exciting area of development with all kinds of implications and consequences across our lives and the economy. Today, we're going to be discussing its impact on cryptography, since the colossal power that quantum computers represent might render existing cryptographic standards obsolete. A very important topic, I'm sure you'll agree, and we've got some real experts here to share their insights. Let's just start with the basic question. What is quantum computing and why does it represent a more powerful type of computing than what we use currently?
Well, actually, this is a very good question to start with. In the traditional computing, which we all know today, it is all based on the concept of different switches, on-off switches, which they call bits, to do all these computation. And then in the quantum computing world, essentially it is, instead of using the on-off switch, it's actually still using on-off switch, but in a different kind of way of doing the on-off switch, in that it is based on the nature of quantum superpositioning and quantum entanglement. So the nature of the quantum is essentially allowing the switch to be in on and off state at the same time, simultaneously. So putting in everyday English is actually allowing millions of classical computer all working together in parallel to solve the same problem, So you can all seeing that is basically making it extremely fast computer. And this is really changing the world because it can make a lot of the impossible tasks today, such as cosmology analysis, DNA analysis, chemical reaction analysis, traffic control analysis, all these kind of things that are impossible, virtually impossible for today's supercomputer and now becoming possible. And in my opinion, the quantum computing is going to be a game changer, the same way that digital computer as we know today has changed our life in the last 70 years.
Thank you, Andrew. So by creating a superposition where a bit can be both on and off simultaneously, you can store much more or you can process much more information within a single or with a far smaller number of bits of relays.
Absolutely.
Okay. I see. So, and why does this pose a risk for cybersecurity? I think it's probably worth explaining a little bit about conventional cryptography and then talking about why quantum computing has an effect on that.
So Lewis, let me start by looking at, what we have today. And I think it's, important to explain, as you said, a bit about cryptography. So, cryptography is nothing new. We have been, humans have been using it for thousands of years, and we use that to protect information. In the context of, the computer age and when we use cryptography, you have heard of this term, secret keys. And a key is a bit like a key for a physical lock. And so, to make it simple, there are two types of keys in modern cryptography. The first one is what we call a symmetric key, and the second type is asymmetric key. So what is a symmetric key? Well, it's a bit like a key on your door. You use the same key to open the door, lock and lock the door. And the important thing is about the key, how you protect it, because it's the same key that allows to open and lock something. So if you misplace your key or someone, cuts a duplicate of the key, then that person also has the ability to get into the locked room. The way that is solved by computing is this asymmetric cryptography was conceived around the mid 70s. So around that time, scientists basically work out, you know, why don't we have a two keys that is mathematically related? And I use the, you know, key, one key to lock the door, and to unlock it, I have to use the corresponding key. So we call that a key pair, and that key pair is mathematically related. And so everything hinges on how you kind of operate a key and protect the key. And you know, I will let Andrew to explain further, you know, why under this asymmetric key kind of context, the mechanism, you know, quantum computing basically is going to impose a significant risk.
Well, thank you, William. I think this is a very good explanation about the fundamental about how encryption really works. So a short answer to the question is that the quantum computer supercomputing power is essentially compressing the time it would take to brute force cracking the key, right? So a fundamental understanding of cracking is that there's really no encryption is 100% secure. The only question is about how long it takes to crack trying all the combinations. So going back to that asymmetric encryption that William mentioned about, the fundamental of it is using math as a relation. The math that they are using as a relation is what we call prime number factorization. Like it's nothing special. It is interesting enough that prime number factorization is very easy one way, but very difficult the other way. So I'll give you a quick example. If I give you a semi-prime number, 21, I think within a second, you can tell me 3 and 7 are the prime number factors of 21. So if I slightly raise the bar a little bit and giving you 221, I think it would take you a few more seconds to tell me back like 13 and 17. So if there is imagine there's a 500 digit long, big semi-prime number, guess how long it would take for a supercomputer today to factor back into the two very large prime number? The answer is 150 years to do that. So that is considered to be secure because it is longer than the average lifespan of a human. So that's considered secure for the last 40 something years already, right? So now, imagine what happened with the quantum computing, supercomputing power is just basically compressing that 150 years by millions time or maybe even hundreds of millions times. And that's a game changer. You know, suddenly that 150 years becomes a few seconds. Then they can reverse back from the public key to the private key. Then everything, you know, under the sun are being cracked, you know, that we rely on today. So that's essentially, you know, why it is posing risk, you know, for the encryption world today.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, Lewis, I can, you know, add one aspect to that. You know, when we talk about encryption, we are just not talking about, you know, major database or, you know, your kind of installation. Today, encryption is used in every aspect of our day-to-day life on the average mobile device. There could be, you know, several, maybe tens, you know, on my machine there is 20 plus different digital certificates, you know, on my system to access, you know, banking kind of services and to access my office network and so on. So the use of encryption is such that it is kind of very widespread. You know, that's why it's not just a central database that we are talking about. It's also what we call the endpoint devices, you know, will also be subject to the varying degree of this risk.
Can I just talk about where we are with quantum computers? I mean, obviously, as you say, everyone is relying on cryptography every day for everything. But presumably access to quantum computers that could threaten that cryptography is pretty limited. There aren't a lot of these floating around, right?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, first of all, quantum computer has already been commercially available. Make no mistake on that. Like 2019, IBM already has released the first commercially available, they call Model Q, the quantum computer. And only that, the public knowledge about their computing power is not reaching the stage where they can crack the traditional encryption yet. And that's the current stage. But the nature of technology development is all we all, as we all know, is that they are always faster than people's imagination. And IBM has already publicly announced that by 2023, which is next year, they will have a 1,000 qubit quantum computers. And that is actually just crossing the line, you know, of the red line, you know, that they're crossing. So this is a quite a dangerous proposition. And imagine it is also important to know that Powell's adversary today, even though they may not have access to a quantum computer powerful enough to crack the RSA or elliptic curve yet, but they are already collecting sensitive data, putting it aside and wait until they get hold of this device, then they will crack it. So the danger has already started.
So not common, but could become so quite quickly. So, well, let's move on to post-quantum cryptography then. So how do you go around neutralizing this risk then?
Yeah, well, fundamentally, the power, as we talk about, the power of quantum computers is in their super high computing power. So the way, the fundamental way to neutralize this is to using non-math-based encryption, because the superpower can crack basically all math-based encryption, like the prime number factorization that I mentioned, or the elliptic curve kind of the encryption. But then non-math-based basically rendering their supercomputing power having no advantage over that. So non-math-based encryption technology is also not new. It has been kind of in parallel development with math-based encryption for almost 50 years, almost side by side, head to head. Only that people were not using them before because they require a bigger key to operate. And bigger keys today is not a problem. But then if you remember like 40 something years ago, the entire computer only has less than 100 kilobyte memory. So making a larger key is virtually unfeasible, you know, at that time. So it's time to make the changes to non-math-based encryption technology.
And one of the related aspect to that, Lewis, is you know, up to now, as Andrew explained, because of limitations in computing power, storage capacity, and so on, the world started with you know, a very short circle key length. At one stage, you know, 30, 40 years ago, a 512-bit key is long enough, it's good enough. But today, the standard is 2048 bits being the norm, you know, in terms of, you know, when you kind of look at how secure it is. You know, as you can see, what the community has done around the world is to extend the key length. But because of the unique attributes of a quantum computer, if you continue to extend the key length, it doesn't mean anything because the power is so great that, you know, you can extend it again, but the system will, you know, as it continues to mature, will actually beat you on, you know, on your own game. And so extending key length probably going forward, you know, is no longer a viable option. As Andrew said, you therefore need to look at an alternative solution using a different type of cryptography to actually solve the problem. And it's not a matter of neutralizing the risk. The risk is always there. You can't neutralize it. But it's actually, you know, how you basically counter that risk and strengthen your ability to protect your data and information.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what you mean by non-math-based cryptography?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, non-math-based technology, as I kind of like briefly talked about 2 minutes ago, was not new. You know, it has been in parallel development with math-based technology for almost 50 years. It's only that it required a larger key to do the encryption and decryption, making it invisible 40 something years ago. And there are many types of non-math based encryption. And the longest time tested one is called code-based encryption. Now, code-based encryption is actually using a error correction technology. You can imagine that it is kind of like inserting random errors into the data and then using the private key as a hint to extract out those errors and returning the original data for you. So a live example, analogy is kind of like you randomly breaking the Rubik's Cube. And then without even knowing what the original form was, like all we know, you know, about Rubik's Cube, we thought the original form is six sides, same color. But then if the original form is an unknown state, you know, how can you return back to the unknown state? It's basically there's no mathematical cracking theory at all. So that's the kind of concept about code-based technologies. So other than code-based, there are other non-math-based encryption methods also, such as lattice-based, hash-based, multivariate-based, supersingular elliptic curve, and the NIST, National Institute of Science and Technology in the U.S., has already started a process in 2016 to study all these like five major methods of a non-math-based and try to make a recommendation. So they started off with about 82 candidates. And then after three rounds of elimination, they are now down to about 15. And they are expecting to announce a recommendation in each of these five categories. And they're anticipating that about 2024, they will have a recommendation coming out. So we're kind of close, but it's kind of like the racing between, you know, the two parallel universities, the development of quantum computers and the NIST process. That's basically how the current stage of the race is happening.
And on that point, interestingly, you know, as Andrew was saying, no cryptographic algorithm is 100% kind of safe. It's just a matter of time when it becomes when it get cracked and becomes unsafe. A few months ago, one of the candidate, called Rainbow, is reported to be broken. What you can see from that is, you know, already at the same time that the world is trying to find a replacement for current cryptographic technologies, there's a kind of a test of time, you know, which of these algorithm actually stood the test of time to demonstrate its robustness and security. And already we are, you know, if that report was proven, then basically one of the finalists is effectively out of the game. It is a matter of time, and we need that time to actually understand the robustness of the shortlisted candidate. And as Andrew said, you know, these some of these methods have been around for many, many years, but there are also a number of new entrants who are much younger. So time is the factor that we also need to consider, when we kind of look into this post-quantum cryptography aspect.
Fascinating. I wanted to bring up the concept of centralized and decentralized systems here. Andrew, you mentioned hashing there, and I'm sure a lot of listeners of the podcast will be familiar with Bitcoin and the SHA-256 algorithm that underpins its cryptography, which, you know, I think relates to some of the concepts that you've talked about, like you can't reverse engineer the solution or the starting point from the solution. But I'm assuming, can you talk a little bit about how quantum computing would render that obsolete? And is there any natural greater vulnerability to centralized or decentralized systems?
Yeah, it is a very good question there. I think I will start with a short answer. A short answer is that all systems are basically equally vulnerable. in front of quantum computers. However, the nature of vulnerability is different between decentralized and centralized system. In a centralized system, as we all know, there's a central authority, you know. So the adversary, you know, has a center of target. Basically, they just need to get hold of the public key of a bank or a central bank or something, and they try to use quantum computers to brute force back to the private key. Then once they have the private key, it's essentially they can do anything they want, such as faking transactions, stealing data, reading database, and all kinds of things. It's just a free hand into whatever they want to do. Now, on the other hand, a decentralized system is spread out. So let's use cryptocurrency as an example, like what you just mentioned. Essentially, all the participants has their own set of key pair. Okay. So using cryptocurrency transaction, like, you know, now, first of all, don't get me wrong. I am a big supporter of blockchain. And because the structure of blockchain has nothing wrong. It is still quantum safe. However, the end points, you know, are not. The end points being the user, right? When Peter is trying to send a Bitcoin to John, Peter has to sign and initiate a transaction. And then the validator or the miners would validate such transaction using the public key of John, right, to validate the transaction, sending the coin to Peter. Now, here's the problem, you know. So if the you can imagine that the whole structure is fundamentally relying on the fact that public key infrastructure is reliable. So if the private key is no longer reliable and can be forged by quantum computing power, the whole thing becomes vulnerable. Everything just got like falling apart, you know, as simple as that. So in fact, there was only about a month ago, there was a reported case that a $325 million was being stolen in a crypto theft. Now, there's no indication that the adversary are using quantum computer to do that. You know, it seems to be it's just an accident that the private key was being exposed. But this is a square proof that if the private key can be forged, you know, not stolen, but can be forged, you know, this kind of theft can happen on a daily basis or even hourly basis. So that's the problem.
Very troubling. Interesting. So the cryptographic vulnerability is similar, but the consequences are different based on whether it's a centralized or decentralized system. Okay, great.
Chris, you know, just to add on to that, the blockchain community is actually aware of that. And there are some of the newer chains that possess the ability, you know, or to be quantum safe. You may come across, you know, what people describe as post-quantum resistant blockchains. I've actually seen, you know, papers related to blockchain architecture that said, you know, we are actually using quantum safe encryption algorithms, you know, in our particular chain. So the community is aware, but as you know, blockchain started a few years ago. There are many, you know, blockchain ecosystems around today, and only a minority is actually, you know, having this, you know, quantum safe attribute. So it is something that the community do need to look into, and you know, we have to determine exactly what measure to take going forward.
Yeah. Can you tell me a little bit about your involvement with the process?
Well, actually, we are. My company, Zero One Communicate, is currently creating a quantum safe blockchain for one of our partners. Mainly like focus on the token, NFT and the smart contract area for exactly the same reason, because of the vulnerability in the digital signature, to be more precise.
And from PwC's aspects, we are looking at the governance perspective of how, what mechanism that you need to use to actually examine the security of your blockchain system, you know, what is the approach to actually countering that particular threat, be that for a blockchain ecosystems or a, you know, traditional kind of ecosystem. We tend to look at that aspect to make sure that, you know, people do protect their sensitive information and data.
Fantastic. So what would you say the timeline for the threat of quantum computing to standard cryptography is? When does that become a clear danger? And what about the solutions that you've been talking about today? When are they going to be deployed?
As we briefly talk about the development of quantum computers, IBM already has announced publicly that they are going to have a 1,000 qubit quantum computer in 2023. And that is exactly kind of like beginning to cross the red line about having enough power to crack the traditional encryption. As we talk about that, technology development is often happen faster than what people can imagine. So especially in the national level, I think, personally, I believe it would be foolish it's foolish to believe that a national, like those kind of countries possesses with enough technical ability, has not already started or even created a quantum computer that is special purpose in doing factorization, to help them cracking information that they want. So in my opinion, I believe the quantum threat already has happened on the national level, only that the tsunami would hit the land when regular power adversary can get hold of this kind of technology. We call that the Q-day. It can happen anytime. Just they won't tell you, when this is happening.
And I think I just, want to supplement two aspects, on top of what Andrew has said. First of all, it's about the nature of quantum computer and, how, in what form would it be available to the general public? As you know, when personal computer comes in, it was like a new toy. And like every kind of new invention, it started with a very high price. So only those who can afford it can actually buy one of those toys. But eventually, it gets into everyone, everyone's life, and we all carry a laptop and now a tablet or some smart devices. It comes in a form where you have to buy one for yourself. But quantum computer in its design, you may see some picture, it's a different technical construct. And with the technology today on distributed computing and so on, it's quite likely that it will be service on tap. So, a university student can buy chunks, of the time, on a quantum computer service kind of platform. It will be probably available on the cloud and so on. And the most importantly, it will coexist with classical computer. So the two types of computer operate side by side because you will not use a quantum computer to do your email on your word processing or your spreadsheet. It's just a waste of resource. So with that, it actually created a situation where you need to have that quantum resistant capability for the classical part of your day-to-day tool, alongside, having that technology in place. The second aspect is that today when we use cryptography, it's interlinked. It's not about me encrypting or signing or protecting my sign, my end, of the system. It's you and I, connected via, say, a VPN, and we can exchange information in a secure manner. And once you get into to your side, you can encrypt it and protect it further. And you know, when you talk about signatures, you send me something that is digitally signed, I have to leverage on the public key infrastructure to validate your signature. So it is not about me upgrading my end of the kind of technical component. We have to do it together. So when the, in one of the NIST report, it actually was, you know, put in a very nice way. It says it has taken almost 20 years to deploy our modern public key infrastructure. It will also take significant time to ensure a smooth and secure migration from today's crypto system to the quantum computing resistant components. And so regardless of whether we can accurately estimate the time, you know, when this Q day arrives, we have to begin now to prepare our project so that we can do it in a controlled manner. It's a bit like, you know, Y2K all over again, except that this time round, you don't actually have a fixed end date called 31st December 1999. You know that day is coming, as Andrew said, it may have already arrived, but you need to actually understand exactly what cryptographic components you have to actually manage that transition in a smooth and secure manner.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. The unilaterally upgrading will have very little effect on vulnerability or security. Excellent. So thank you to William and Andrew for their insights. A really interesting, very technical topic, but one of great importance for financial markets and beyond that in the years to come. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Don't forget to like and subscribe on your preferred podcast platform. There'll be more podcasts coming out soon on lots of other related topics. You should also be aware of our Future of Capital Markets report, which was published on March 31st. You can find that on our website and also a link to the conference that launched the event where we had some expert speakers talking about the topic of digitalizing capital markets around ESG areas and cash settlement and lots of other very interesting things. So do make sure to check that out. Coming up soon, we have our DMI symposium, which is taking place May 10th. You can find more details about what will be discussed there on our website. So do look that up and see you for our next podcast. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.